Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Lamb McRae-Lane Legal Podcast. Today is the second episode of In the Line of Fire. I'm your host, Christopher Gerber. The program is brought to you by the law firm of Lamb McRae-Lane, a full-service regional law firm based in Westchester, Pennsylvania, with additional offices in Philadelphia, Newtown Square, Oxford, Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and Wilmington, Delaware. The firm has served in the Philadelphia region since 1971. Today's episode, Building Trust in Law Enforcement, will address how municipal police departments can and should implement the highest standards of conduct and performance in compliance with federal and state law, while also ensuring the public's confidence in the men and women who protect and serve us all. The information provided during this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. You should not act upon any of the information provided without seeking legal counsel. Moreover, the views and opinions expressed today are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Lamb McRae-Lane. Ladies and gentlemen, today we are very, very fortunate to have as our guests, first, Scott Bond, who serves as the director of the Pennsylvania Chiefs Association. Scott is the former chief of police of Westchester Borough, where we're broadcasting today. We also have retired chief of police Jim Adams, who serves as the PA Chiefs Accreditation Program Coordinator. And we have back with us today, Jerry Simpson, former chief of police, who now serves the PA Chiefs Association as the testing and consulting manager. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Chris.
So with your respective decades of law enforcement experience, I look very forward to addressing how municipal police departments and their officials can provide the highest level of services through the development and implementation of legally compliant and practical policies. I'm so glad that the director could join us today, but we're gonna first start with Chief Adams, who serves as the coordinator for the PLEAC program. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here. Any opportunity I have to promote professional policing, I welcome that opportunity.
And before we get into the PLEAC program, I just want to make a first statement. As a follow-up to the first episode when Chief Simpson and I were talking about municipal policing in Pennsylvania, as a civil rights lawyer, it is frustrating to me to see that there is no mandated set of uniform standards for municipal police officers to follow. And thank goodness the PA Chiefs Association has the PLEAC program. So I just want to make that lead in, Jim.
You're right on point, and that's why Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police took it upon themselves to develop an accreditation program for law enforcement in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Just a real brief history of the program. Going back in the late 90s, a survey or a study was done on policing in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and it was discovered, sadly, that a majority of the police departments didn't have any policy, and those agencies that did have policy, there was no consistency across the Commonwealth. So every police department, police officer was pretty much singing to a different sheet of music, so to speak. So the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police took it upon themselves to put together professional law enforcement executives, representatives of municipalities, the legal community, and put together a team to develop what they felt back in that time period were the best practices in providing professional law enforcement services. The accreditation program rolled out live in July of 2001 with 108 best practices, or we refer to as standards. Fast forward, here we are, 2026. We currently have 203 police departments accredited. Our standards are up to 125, which is a little bit of a misnomer because a lot of those 125 standards are bulleted out, which individually are individual best practices. So if you look at any accredited police department in Pennsylvania, they're subscribing to 370 best practices. What does that mean? That means that their policy manual, their written directives, their procedures all conform to the 370 best practices. But part of our program, it's not just about having a good policy manual sitting on the shelf. The policy manual isn't going to do the department much good if nobody follows it. So for the initial assessment, which is a look back over the previous 12 months when our assessment team is there, they have to have a minimum of two proofs of compliance for each one of those best practices. A proof of compliance is showing the assessment team that the agency, their staff, is actually complying with their policy, which means they're complying with best practices. The program's very fluid. It's a live program. We went from 108 standards when it rolled out to 125 now. We have a standing committee constantly reviewing standards as far as best practices, because we know providing law enforcement services is changing. Sometimes for the good, sometimes and maybe not so good, but the reality of it is providing professional policing is constantly changing, and we try to adapt and stay in front of that also. And I can cite a lot of examples as to as to why. So that's pretty much what the program's about.
That is so positive that is there, because, again, here in Pennsylvania, we're a commonwealth, and we are a very fragmented political structure. And anybody know how many municipal police departments exist today? Anybody want to take a stab at that?
Yeah, Chris, it's over 1,000. There's probably, or approximately, I believe, at last count, 1,069 municipal policing agencies.
Yeah, and that's not the state police, right, Scott?
Correct.
These are municipal police departments.
That's correct. And probably 1,500 law enforcement entities across the state.
Okay, all right. And Jim, how many are accredited now? You said
203.
Right. So that's a lot that aren't.
Exactly.
And I have to share this too. As a civil rights lawyer, labor lawyer later in life, I'm out counseling with these police departments, or I'm defending them when they get sued. I got to tell you, gentlemen, there are too many of them out there with not just deficient policies, but some of them have none.
Correct.
Some of them have none. And it's just mind-boggling to me that the General Assembly isn't taking the lead on this. You guys are. You guys are making sure that there is this service out there to provide them with some uniformity and the highest standards that are going to comply with today's laws. Would that be a fair assessment?
That's correct. And one of the things to make clear for those who are listening, we don't come in and tell a police department or a municipality how to run their police department. What we provide them are what we consider the best practices, which I already alluded to. Then it's up to them how to figure out how to comply with those best practices. And then we, the assessment, we send in three trained assessors from, they could be from any part of Pennsylvania, to review their policies, because we recognize there are different policing cultures in the four corners of Pennsylvania. It doesn't make one right, one wrong. It's just a reality. And so we allow, you know, some leniency there, but they have to comply with the standard. It's sort of like when I describe it, you know, and I've told chiefs this that are reluctant. I say, you know, if I tell you, you got to get to California, you got to get to San Francisco in 10 days, a lot of different ways to get there. You figure out how you want to get there, as long as you're there in 10 days. So same way with our standards. You figure out how to get there. You know, we'll evaluate them and make sure that you're on point.
Well, let's jump from that. You figure out how to get there. And that's where what we're trying to do, I think, together is to build the bridge between the black letter policy, the black letter law, the operations of the police department, and the governing body that is ultimately responsible to make sure that the police department is acting constitutionally. And Chief Simpson, this is something that you talked about last time. It isn't just the black letter policy or the black letter law, but you're talking about culture. You want to add on that?
Yeah,
Jerry?
Actually, the point Jim just made there about there are various operations or policing cultures across the Commonwealth, and you know, I think one of the benefits that's often forgotten in this pursuit to become an accredited organization, and there are so many, is that you get to create these systems that help with the healthy function or the proper function of every organization. It's an education opportunity, not just for your police officers. It's an educational opportunity for your elected officials on why these things matter. In preparation for this program, we talked about what accreditation is. You know, sometimes, you know, we forget some of these other benefits. When you sit down and talk to your elected officials, why it's important to have trained internal affairs investigators, right? And what will you mitigate by having trained people in that space, right? Errors in those in that process that may cost you the community dollars that they don't need to spend, or those ways. So I think it's And there are several ways to attack this. And I'll say that, you know, as this program goes on a little bit, explores, like, how do you actually do it? We can talk about some of the benefits to, you know, why the organization managing, you know, their journey is so important.
Yeah. Well, why don't we do this? How does a municipality start the process, Jim? What should they do? Call you?
Give me a call. We have, in fact, anybody listening to this, we have a lot of information about accreditation on our public-facing webpage. Just Google or go to Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police, pachiefs.org. There's an accreditation tab. Those 125 best practices, those standards are all listed there. The list of accredited agencies are listed there. And there's just a wealth of information about it. But going back to the question, as far as if a municipality is interested, they want to sign up, the first step is what we do in an enrollment. Enroll into the program. It's just simply the chief and a representative of the municipality. It could be the mayor. It can be the president of borough council, or it can be the borough manager or township manager. They both put their signature on a letter wishing to enroll in our accreditation program. And then what that does, we open up a lot of resources to assist them. And there's a small enrollment fee. If the chief of the police department is a member of PA Chiefs, $250 enrollment fee. If they're not a member, $500 enrollment fee. And the reality of it is right now there's a push for membership, and the enrollment or the membership to PA Chiefs fees are waived. So it's actually cheaper to become a member, and there's a lot of benefits. But anyhow, then once they enroll, we give them a 5-year window to schedule their initial assessment. During that 5 years, they take a look at all those 125 standards. They look at their existing policy manual and make sure that they have policy or procedures in place meeting all of those standards. It's very time consuming, but a lot of that is predicated upon, has the agency over time kept up with it?
But isn't it worth it? When you say time consuming and there is some cost, we are talking about people who are there to protect us, and they may have to deprive life and liberty, right? It's
right.
Probably one of the most important governmental functions out there is to provide law enforcement services. So in my humble view, this is a no-brainer.
Well, you're absolutely right. And a lot of those critical tasks that are very low frequency, they don't occur very often. Police officers don't have time to look at their policy manual and say, oh, gee, is this an appropriate use of force? That's why part of our standards is all of those use of force, all the weapons, both deadly, lethal, and non-lethal weapons, they have to be trained on an annual basis. The policy has to be trained on an annual basis. De-escalation has to be trained on an annual basis, where it's very rare that you find non-accredited police departments doing that robust training on a regular basis of their policy manual. But again, if you want your officers to comply with it, you got to be able to make sure that they're being trained and refreshed on a regular basis.
In representing mostly small municipal governments, I find that unacceptable that they are not looking into this and they're not ensuring that their officers are trained. It shouldn't matter, in my view, whether you have a 2-man police department or a 100-man police department. It shouldn't matter. They should have really the training on the same standards. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, I agree. And the one thing you just touched on there, we do have an agency that is 2 full-time officers, supplemented by a couple part-time officers, and they're an accredited agency, as is the Pennsylvania State Police, Philadelphia Police Department. I can name a lot more, but my point being is we have a 2-officer agency and a 5,000-plus officer agency or trooper agency, and we're holding them accountable to the same standards. Because when somebody picks up the phone and dials 911, they're not thinking, oh, gee, is it my 2-man police department that's responding, or is it Pennsylvania State Police?
That's great. Yeah.
And this same, you know, police officers responding and hopefully are going to address the situation properly. Yeah. And accreditation helps give those officers, no matter whether they're from a large agency, a small agency, some of the tools to handle that situation appropriately.
And even if you're looking at it from a cost perspective, if that's all the municipality cares about is cost, my goodness, this is mitigating risk, is it not?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And some of the studies actually show when you compare accredited agencies and non-accredited agencies, the accredited agencies get sued less often than non-accredited. When they do get sued, if there is a payout, it's substantially less if the agency is accredited. Workers' compensation claims go down for accredited agencies. Liability goes down. Auto liability goes down. Auto physical damage actually goes down to accredited agencies. And that's why some of your insurance carriers that insure municipalities against liability risk are actually giving discounts to municipalities whose agencies are accredited, because they're actually saving the insurance company money.
And what you just said, what I'm trying to do when I represent a municipal client is to make sure I'm educating the governing body, whether that's the borough council, the township board of supervisors, the township board of commissioners. They need to be connected too.
Yes.
And I look forward to working with you, your organization going forward, and making sure that we build that bridge between, again, the black letter law policy and the governance of the department, which Jerry and I talked about that in our last episode, is how do you build that bridge? How do you make sure that this works? Because as you said, Jim, you might have the best policies in the world sitting on a shelf. If they're not implemented, and if there is a lack of training and no enforcement or evaluation, it's for naught, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I used to do a lot of training before I retired. And depending on the class, I would sometimes ask the class, a well-written policy, is it your best friend or worst enemy? And get a little bit of debate going. And the reality of it is, it could be either. If you follow policy, it's your best friend to insulate you from, you know, frivolous lawsuits.
Right.
But if you violate well-written policy, it's your worst enemy.
That's a great point. And that brings up something during episode one we discussed. How do you make sure this all works? This is a perfect time of year, by the way. We just had municipal elections. So we have a lot of turnover of new people who really, they mean well, they've campaigned, and they want to serve their community, but they don't have any training or real knowledge of police operations. And I think that your program is perfect to help them with that. And as a lawyer, I try to help them with that. And one thing that Jerry and I talked about in the first episode was, let's have a fire drill with our elected officials. Let's pretend that there was a shooting in your borough at 2 a.m. Somebody's dead. There's a criminal investigation going on. CNN has just swooped in, and there's reporters everywhere. Are you ready for that? I can almost promise you, most of the folks that I go out and speak to, they're not.
Well, the agency should be if they're accredited, because, again, one of the standards for unusual circumstances, we require them to do periodic, whether it's tabletop exercises or actual exercises, you know. Because, you know, and it's been said over and over again, and I didn't make this up, but it's true. You play the way you practice. Well, if you never practice, God only knows how you're going to end up playing when that split-second decision has to be made.
That's right. And that's what I say to my municipal clients. You don't want to learn about police, your own police policies in the deposition. That's, it's late. It's too late at that point. And what officials don't understand, and this it boggles my mind, is that the buck stops with them. You know, what really frustrates me about the media is that when there's a critical incident, somebody gets hurt, there's body cam footage of police officers handling an event, and it's ugly because a lot of what you do is ugly. They don't know the full background of it, and government officials don't really understand that the buck stops with them. It's their responsibility to make sure police officers are being trained and, frankly, should be reaching out to your agency to make sure that they are. So this is something that I'm definitely going to carry the torch and try to enlighten them that this is the way to go.
Well, and the other thing, too, part of that training should be, and for the general public also, use of force is not pretty, no matter how justified it is, no matter how, you know, constitutionally permissible it is. Right. It is not pretty. And you talk about, you know, what gets displayed on TV. You know, everybody has a cell phone. Everybody's more, you know, inclined to be taking video that they can post instead of dialing 911 sometimes. But you got to be cautious as far as what you see. And I use the analogy with football. We've all watched football games. And, oh, yes, you know, touchdown. The football, you know, he made it into the end zone, you know, just by a fraction of an inch. Well, that was the camera angle that you were watching at the moment. But how many cameras are being, you know, recording that supposed touchdown, but different camera angles show, no, it's not a touchdown. It gets reversed. And now it is first and goal at the 6-inch line. And so it's the same thing, you know, with what you see on TV. You got to be cognizant of what the camera angle is, but the most important camera angle is the angle the police officer was viewing the incident at.
Well, you just hit it. The courts will view. And this is another thing that the public doesn't understand, that when determining whether a police officer's use of force is reasonable, is to be judged through that police officer's eyes, not from the camera at the Wawa, not from the camera over there, not from a witness's testimony. It should be viewed based upon what that officer is viewing and feeling and sensing in that split-second judgment timing. Now, granted, credibility comes into play in all of that, but that's right. That's how the courts are supposed to view it. I do have to ask you one thing about use of force, and I'm glad you brought up use of force, because we're going to talk about that a little bit in our next episode. De-escalation. Is de-escalation one of those mandatory elements in the PLEA Act policies?
Yes, we have a standard as far as de-escalation. So it's not an option. The agency actually has to have a written directive. In fact, I just happen to have a copy of it right in front of me. It says a written directive stating that de-escalation strategies will be applied to reduce the need for the utilization of force when tactically feasible and providing guidance on those strategies. And then also, too, that policy has to be trained on an annual basis.
Right. And the other thing that is frustrating to me in the media is there seems to suggest that if a person thinks that they are being unlawfully arrested by a police officer, that they have a right to resist, that that is a form of protest, that I do not have to cooperate with someone who I think is unlawfully arresting me. That is flat out wrong, isn't it, Jim?
That is correct. There are other avenues to pursue. If you feel you've been wrong, the agency itself, and there again, an accredited agency is going to have internal investigation policy in place, to investigate complaints by citizens, by anyone. Also, every use of force has to be reviewed by policy. And I can give the real quick example. I get a phone call from a chief newly accredited agency, sort of in a panic, and he says, "I guess you're going to revoke my accreditation." And I said, "Well, you tell me why." Two officers, they got in a chase, didn't follow the pursuit policy, and there were some other issues too. And I said, "Well, what did you do, chief?" And he said, "Well, they were reprimanded, they were retrained, reassigned." He said, "They're two good officers." And I said, "Well, before accreditation, what would you have done?" He said, "Well, first of all, I probably never found out about it unless a citizen called complaining.
Right.
But because of accreditation and the mandatory reporting and review through the command staff and requiring it to end up on my desk," he said, "I found out about it." And I said, "And what did you do with the officers?" And he told me, it's not about, we're human beings.
Right.
Police officers, you pick any profession, people are going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
Was it intentional or a mistake of the heart?
Right.
And in this case, you know, accreditation's working for them. It wasn't ignored. It was taken care of.
Yeah. Well, on use of force, not to get too much into the weeds, because we're already running out of time, but I'm looking at 136. And the reporting requirements, this is interesting and very good, that in the event there's a use of physical force, there has to be a report. We get that. Or where it's alleged that the officer used force. This is important.
Yes.
So where you have a complaint where someone says that officer used unreasonable force on me, hurt me, and the officer clearly didn't or thinks he didn't, he still has to prepare a report on that.
Absolutely.
Is that part of your policies, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And that is very, as a litigator, I will say that the sooner that the officer documents that, the better. Because if they wait and don't do it, then it gets stale, and then he's going to be cross-examined, you know, by a plaintiff's attorney. So I think that's a very good thing. Another thing I just want to point out real quick is qualified immunity. We have to talk about qualified immunity just for a minute. There is this misperception that I read in the newspaper that the doctrine of qualified immunity is a police officer's get-out-of-jail-free card. That is absolutely untrue. Would you agree with me?
Absolutely.
All right. Just so the public knows, qualified immunity is a doctrine that protects law enforcement and other government officials when the law under the circumstances of the event is unclear. It's just patently unfair to hold a police officer liable for a constitutional violation when the law is unclear. To give you an example, when lawyers and judges are arguing in chambers or in a courtroom and can't figure out the law, why are you going to find the officer liable for something that we can't even figure out? So I will tell you, in defending police officers for the past 30 years in use of force cases, it's very difficult to have a civil rights violation charge dismissed against an officer on qualified immunity, gentlemen. I don't know what your experience is. May the director or Jerry, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think you're absolutely correct, Chris. And there are a lot of misperceptions about what is and what is not qualified immunity. I know I've published a number of things about this to help clarify this issue, because I think the misconceptions also extend to law enforcement officers themselves and how they're protected.
Yeah. And so, again, this is not a political program. Policing shouldn't be political, but it is out there. And I'm just going to share my 30 years of experience that this qualified immunity issue has been absolutely misinterpreted by the media. It is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It is a doctrine that should not be vitiated. It should be, and I think the courts do a fine job on it. No matter which judge, you know, sits on the bench in the Eastern District, Middle District, Western District, they're fantastic federal judges out there. They've got a great support staff. I want the public to know that when I'm in a courtroom, we've got a fair shake. So that is a misnomer out there. And then I know we're running out of time. Thank you, Eric. And then the other thing is we really need to educate our government officials so our government officials can educate the public. And I'm going to end kind of there, that where your program, your PLEA Act program should be in combination with the local government then adopting these policies. And we can talk about that in the next program. Can't wait to get into that. I got three cops in the room with a lawyer, so we're going to get into it a little bit. They are the ultimate policymakers. I can't wait to hear from Chief Bond about that and Chief Simpson. We're going to get into that in the next program. The bottom line is this. This program is well worth it. I would encourage all municipal police departments who are not accredited to reach out to Chief Adams and to Scott Bond to discuss the prospect of becoming accredited. So, Jim, I'd really like to thank you for that.
You're quite welcome.
We really do. Any final thoughts on that, gentlemen?
My contact information is all on the webpage, you know, and I encourage anybody interested in accreditation, take a look at it and review the material we have. And if you have any questions, give me a call, shoot me an email. Both my email address and my phone number are posted there.
All right. And I guess my final points would be, again, building this bridge. I look forward to working with your organization and building the bridge between especially the new government officials. And in fact, we've got a local government 101 program for the Western Chester County Chamber coming up this Saturday at the Chester County Training Center. And I encourage anybody to please come to that. This will be part of the program where we're training new elected officials who need to know, new mayors, new council members, new supervisors, new commissioners. You really need to be aware of this because you ultimately will be found responsible for making sure that your municipal police departments are acting constitutionally. And working with these gentlemen really is the way to do it. So again, I thank you all for your participation today.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you, Chris.